Hello and welcome to the Dead Darlings podcast. I'm Rebecca Cooney.
I'm a very croaky Laurie Eaves.
And I'm Hannah Chutzpah.
Dead Darlings is a monthly podcast for the spoken word community. Each month we'll be bringing you interviews, tips, inspiration and above all, awesome poetry from the spoken word scene. We'll also be telling you what's on and where you can submit your work.
This month we'll be interviewing the monstrous, and I say that with love, Tom Juniper.
Wow. Wow.
It'll all make sense.
It is the name of Tom's collection, to be fair.
We're not just being mean. And we'll also be giving you a sneak preview of our bonus episode, which is on Jacqueline Safra's 100 Lockdown Sonnets. But first, it's been a while, guys.
It's been a while.
It has been a while. Thank you very much for bearing with us.
That just happens sometimes, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Life gets in the way and we need to prioritise other stuff, and that's okay. Yeah. That's what we've done. And now we're back.
We've come back refreshed.
I like to think of poetry like a cactus. Like, I can ignore it and it can be cool when I come back. It's fine. It's not a fancy orchid. It's a cactus. It's there. It's sturdy. It can take a break every now and again.
It can also really, really hurt you if you sit on it.
We're also back with 33% more cat. Oh, no, 50% more cat, because there were two cats. There's another cat. I'm a word person, can you tell? We've got 50% more cat. And in fact, our guest this month, Tom Juniper, also has a cat. So any background noises people hear, I'll try and edit them out. But there may be some cat going on in the background of this. So hopefully none of our listeners are audio allergic, I don't know, to cats.
Laurie, you haven't got a cat. Sort it out.
No, I know. I haven't got a cat around here. It's true.
Yeah, but he has an actual
allergy. I have allergens. I think that's that's a good reason not to have
Let's
a
get
cat
one of the
around.
Bald ones. Fine.
They're a bit weird, aren't they?
Yeah, get a little goblin boy.
No offence to any of our bald cat listeners.
What is this? Dead purring podcast?
We've been gone too long. We're just tangents now. We're just made of tangents.
That was the name of my upstairs neighbour's cat growing up. He was a maths teacher with a cat called Tangent.
That's wow. A good name for the cat.
The tangent has gone very meta now.
Sorry.
I hope this stays through the edit because this is great material.
Is it? Okay. Since the last episode, a lot has happened. I can't remember if I'd actually done Glastonbury. Last episode we put
I don't out. Think you had done Glastonbury the last time we recorded. Do you want to tell us about doing Glastonbury Festival?
Yeah, just because it's about the coolest thing I'll ever do, so I'm going to milk it, guys.
Yeah.
It was fucking awesome. I had the best time. The sets went really well. I had 2 25-minute sets. It was amazing. I heard some awesome other poetry. I met some fabulous poets. I just had the best time, and then I was at Glastonbury. So, like, you know, on top of that, had the best time. So, yeah, it was amazing. I loved it very much. Applications for this year are open right now.
Oh, wow.
They are?
Yes. Please go and apply for it, because you never know, you might get in. I'd applied in previous years, not got in. This year I applied and got in. So just do it, because it is brilliant.
Also, Rebecca, you told us a bit about your Glastonbury experience last summer. And it seemed like you had something that you could sell for money while you were at Glastonbury.
I did. Yeah, that is true. I also put out a pamphlet on Allographic with help from the wonderful Faye Roberts. It's called Where the Lights Come On. I feel like I should have it in my hands now because I'm so used to doing it on stage going, this is the book.
Listeners can't see this, but Hannah's just waving a copy of the book off her
bookshelf. I alphabetized my bookshelf. Oh. That's what I've been up to since we've been away, so I can easily grab it.
Mm-hmm. Anything else, Hannah? Was that it?
That's basically been it. Yeah, that's been all I've done.
Nice. Apart from that, it's been an interesting 6 months, but that's definitely been the absolute highlight. Apply for Glastonbury, guys. It's awesome. How about you guys? What have you been up to?
I have become part of the furniture at Genesis Poetry Slam. I can't remember if I was the last time we...
Who can remember?
I think you might have been, but... the other
maybe
two had not been recruited yet. It was a little
gotcha.
Bit. It was a little bit more up in the air, ad hoc.
That sounds right. Yes. So I'm now. Yes. So So Laurie has been holding the reins of the Genesis Poetry Slam for some time, and I have now joined his crew. And we now have two other incredible poets who've joined the crew: Karina Sultana and Panos Skoutelis. And it is, I believe, London's only three-round poetry slam. And it happens every month, apart from not this month, not January, we take that off. Most months at the Genesis Cinema in the East End. So yeah, I do that.
It's the nicest slam. It's just a lovely vibe, and you guys have kept that vibe so lovely. And yeah, it's good. If you can get there in London, guys, go, because it's lovely.
Yeah, I so there's that one, and there's Insight that I run as a host, and I've ascended the poetry scene into the status of furniture, and I actually really enjoy being furniture. I tended to do like all right in slams, but I very rarely won them, and this way I get to perform basically one poem every single time, and I don't have to worry about if I'm going through. It's actually kind of perfect for me.
Honestly, when you say you're part of the furniture, I'm having this vision of you as like a kind of pre-Raphaelite version of the wardrobe in Beauty and the Beast.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I feel like that really works.
Yeah.
What we don't mean by part of the furniture is that Hannah's poetry is wooden. It's not like that.
But yeah, I don't know that I've done loads else. I rejigged my flat, including alphabetizing the poetry shelf, which feels very satisfying. The book with the title Jerks at Work or Swearing is Good for You are on shelves that you cannot see when I'm having a meeting. That's me. Laurie, how about you? What have you been up to?
What have I been up to? I've rejigged my flat in that I've moved since the last recording. And I did just have room on the bookshelves for all the books. But then for
you
Christmas, I got the complete Emily Dickinson, and that has thrown the entire thing. Like, that is it's like a brick, this book. And now I'm like, oh, shoot, I've actually just completely screwed up this whole system. It's going to have to be one in, one out with books from now on, I think.
I've honestly sort of realised that something integral to my sense of interior design is having slightly too many books for the bookshelves available. And I'm kind of okay with that. Like, I'm adopting it as an aesthetic. And
I wish I was okay with it, but I'm not. I can't stand it. So there's that. Yeah, Hannah's already talked about Genesis. Done a couple of things with the Poetry Takeaway. A few gigs here and there. It's been all right. Poetry wise, been doing some nice, been doing some writing, which I've been enjoying. Got a few publications that are about to happen this month, so it should happen by the time this goes out. So I'll probably be talking about them on my social media and things. But yeah, that's nice. It's nice to have some new poems coming out. So yeah, that's me. Okay. How about you, Tom?
I guess the thing that I've been doing recently is, and some people listening to this will understand what I'm saying here, trans admin. Okay. Yeah, I've been trying to change my name and gender with various bits of like official people. So had a whole thing with the NHS going, oh no, we never change anyone's name or gender. That's not a thing. And me going,
right.
Yeah, it really is.
Sorry, plenty of cis women get married and change their name. They do name changes all the time.
That was the best part when I was like, oh, I've brought my deed poll in. I'd like to change my name. They were like, oh, yeah. And I was like, I'd like to change my gender. They were like, well, oh, we don't do name changes.
We just did.
And I was like, I think you do. So had an argument. And then they worked out that when they did their trans awareness training, they probably should have included the admin staff in that.
And now I'm
doing the same thing with the trying to get a passport thing. And apparently, and keep this in or not as you choose, just because it's top of my mind right now, because it's breaking my head. I sent all of my documentation in that they wanted, and they kept saying, send us more documentation, we haven't got proof that you're using your name in public life. And I was like, well, I've sent you bills, I've sent you bank statements, I've sent you everything. And it turned out that the problem was that they couldn't see that I was using my middle name, so they could see that I was Tom Juniper, and they could see that I was T.S. Juniper, but the S could be anything. It might not be my actual middle name.
Do you know
how many people use their middle name like all the time in everyday life?
Yeah.
Jesus.
I was like, that's your problem?
Yeah.
I learned a fact this week, which I have to share on the basis of name changing, which is apparently in Italy, it's very, very, very difficult to change your name. Like, they massively frown on it.
Yes.
Frown upon it on the basis that, you know, your family name is very, very important. And one of the ways that you have to prove that you really live in this new name is publish 3 books.
There's got to be a publisher that's just being like, I will publish any old bullshit for you.
Yeah, any nonsense.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Just the change your name poetry press. Il Nombre poetry press.
El Nombre.
Right?
I think El Nombre taught maths on CBBC, Rebecca.
Yes! I was going to say that.
He was a chipmunk. Yeah. And his sidekick was Little Juan. It was probably not PC now.
No, I don't think it was.
Anyway, sorry, I've digressed into talking about El Nombre, which is always actually my favourite subject.
So this month we've decided not to have a hot topic like we normally do, or like we've been doing sort of for the last few episodes, because honestly, it's been a rough sort of 6 months for people, certainly within our poetry community and I think the wider poetry community. I think anybody actually who's aware of poetry in the UK, to be honest. So we've had the deaths of the fabulous poet Boyega Odabanjo, the death of Benjamin Zephaniah, who was kind of this era-defining poet for British poetry, and also kind of a bit closer to home for us in London, or at least a certain circle of London poetry, Kaz Anne Moy, who is Taryn Lewis's mother, who she was always there to greet people at the beginning of Boomerang and kind of was just a huge part of the poetry scene. You know, she was Mama Kaz as well. So yeah, it's been it's been a loss-filled few months, if that is not an oxymoron.
Yeah. It's hard to know what to say about some of them. Boyega was such a fantastic poet who had so much promise and years and years of fantastic writing ahead of him, that's been taken away very, very, very cruelly under some really horrible circumstances that have obviously hit a lot of people really hard, not least our friends at Bad Betty Press, where he was an editor, people at Bath Mag, where he was an editor, just a truly terrific poet whose work, I think, is just phenomenal. And we're really going to miss him and his writing. I don't think any of the three of us knew him that well personally, but we had done gigs with him and things.
He was
the kind of person
times.
Who was always around. It's a real shame. Benjamin Zephaniah, I mean, what can you say about Benjamin Zephaniah? It's just, honestly, like, for so many people, the poet who got them into poetry. Benjamin, I remember being a kid at primary school and another kid handing me Talking Turkeys and saying, you should read this. And just even today, like, when poetry has become in a way a lot more well known amongst kids, like, the idea of any kid handing another child a poetry book and saying, read this, is still really alien and not something that's common. And so to have had that, you know, back in the 1990s is incredible. And the fact that he continued his work all the way up to last year was fantastic.
And was, I think, uniformly the thing everybody was saying, and certainly I've experienced as well, was that he was, you know, a properly famous person who was also just incredibly willing to sit and chat to emerging poets and to share his knowledge and to platform them and to talk to them and to offer them advice and guidance. Mm. I actually spoke to him about this time last year about coming on the podcast.
Oh, really?
Sort of never happened. But yeah, and he was so, I mean, I was pathetic, right? I was fangirling like you would not believe. And it was at a work do, so I was supposed to be being professional. I was like, would you come on my poetry podcast? And he was so sweet about it and so lovely. And that was one of those things that just, it's kind of, you know, never ended up happening, but I just think the fact that he was just so willing to just go, of course, and that's something that people have uniformly said, you know, that he just made time for other poets.
He's also just somebody who was incredibly popular and loved, but in a mainstream way, but who was never mainstream, was always radical, was always able to put his point across on things in ways that would be considered radical, would be considered you know, difficult, but he put them across with respect and with love, and was able to express himself in a really articulate way. Like back when he was on Question Time and talking about, will Brexit impact fishing quotas? And his answer was, well, I think fish belong in the sea. And that's the end of it. Like, yeah. He was just an incredible person. And then Kaz, I mean, we all three know Kaz personally, and have been to a lot of gigs where Kaz has been there. Kaz was an incredible poet, and then obviously an incredible kind of friend to all of us and to people in the poetry scene, and really was kind of familial. But also Kaz, his work as a crew member at Boomerang or at Process, where she was quite content to take the role of working the door, working the merch stand, sorting out, making sure things were happening and that people were happy and okay. Like,
and making that into a vital kind of, you know, welcome to our community, come in, yeah, take a seat, you're welcome. You know, my mum said she spoke to her the first event she went to with me, and she was like, oh my God, I just feel like I'm part of the room now. I feel like I belong, which I think is something Kaz did for everybody.
And we don't always talk about and celebrate the people in poetry who are slightly more behind the scenes. Not that Kaz wasn't an amazing poet, but somebody who, you know, wouldn't host necessarily a night, but would be absolutely vital in running it. And you know, we all love live poetry and working it, and we tend to talk more about the hosts, or we tend to talk more about the poets, but we don't always talk about the people who actually are just absolutely vital to keeping things running, who are quite happy to sit back and let the thing happen and not be hogging the limelight. And Kaz was incredible at that, and yeah, she's going to be really missed. Also, we won't go too far into it, but Shane McGowan was one of the world's greatest poets, and he died as well.
And I think it's the sort of thing where it's difficult to know what to say when somebody dies, you know, all three of these fantastic people that you sort of, as people who try and find words for everything, right? That is our habit. That is, if I can only put the right words on this, I will have tamed it. I will have made it better. I will have found a way through it. And sometimes you have to live with the limit of your words.
With Boyega passing away, when a young poet dies, there's something like, anything big happens to a poet, write about it, right? But it feels like there's something a bit galling about, he should be around writing about it.
And did also write very much about his own death.
Oh, it was absolutely haunting rereading, like, Jesus. But there is something of, I don't know, this happened a little bit when Dean passed away now about 3 years ago. This is terrible. I should write something. And then this instinct comes in of like, nah, this is not the right time. This is not what you do. They should be. Yeah. And also on the Benjamin Zephaniah front, like, so we talked a little bit about him as a plain speaker, but as an activist, I knew him via, didn't meet him to have a chat, but had some mutual friends in activist and police monitoring circles. And when I first got into, I used to volunteer with NetPol, the Network for Police Monitoring, who remain excellent, netpol.org, fuck the police. But I turned up as a middle class.
Is that part of the URL?
No. Unfortunately, quite fair. But I turned up as a middle class white girl who did a, can you believe they arrested me for being at a demo? And then got a bit more into finding out what was going on and hearing Benjamin Zephaniah talking at Brixton Town Hall about his cousin's death at the hands of the police. That meeting really transformed something in me about how I approached my activism, both in terms of what the other stories are out there and how much I need to shut up and listen and learn. And the depth of a lot of the stuff going on. Like, he was an incredible speaker in all kinds of spaces. And also me and my partner went to a circus around Christmas time, just because circus, and it was great fun and it was lovely. But I was quite surprised and touched that they, one of the performers who is apparently also dyslexic, and Benjamin Zephaniah was dyslexic, when while we were putting this together, Benjamin Zephaniah died, and I want to read this poem that he wrote. And and that is not a space I expected to hear poetry, and I love that, where you get these people who cut across a whole scene. Cross genre, everything. It was absolutely lovely.
Yeah, I mean, one of the only times I really saw him was with a band, and it was amazing. Like just completely cross media, cross groups, cross different boundaries, and like you said, with activism, Hannah, just was instrumental in so many different ways in how a lot of people see the world, and that's an amazing legacy to leave.
Yeah.
Cool.
So if you need to take a breath, and we will crack on and do an interview.
Let's do an interview.
This month's interview is with Tom Juniper. Tom is a Sheffield-based poet whose work often focuses on the experience of being other, whether that's talking about being autistic or part of the queer community, or talking about the more mysterious ideas of the other found in folklore. He has competed in the Great Northern Slam, the Hammer and Tongue National Final, the Axis Slam, Word War, All Beehive Slam, Poetry at Your Place, and even the Anti-Slam. He's also an educator and a workshop leader with a background in youth work and arts education. He delivers poetry workshops through the Writers' Workshop in Sheffield and online. His pamphlet Monstrous is published by Allographic and was adapted into a show at this year's Edinburgh Fringe. Tom, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you for having me. Nice to see you all.
You too, you too. I haven't seen you since I was up at the Edinburgh Fringe, and I'm sure we'll chat a bit more about that show later. First up, would you like to share a poem with our listeners?
Oh, yeah. I can do that. This is a poem from the collection Monstrous, which is various monsters talking back to humanity and telling them what they think. And this is a poem about the Striga, who is a Eastern European monster who can exist. A Striga is something that people become. A Striga would be like within a human being, and they might emerge at some point. So this is a poem about that. We were born ready to bite. Our mother feared to suckle us, so sharp were our teeth, so pointed, so bright. But still, we tried hard to be good. Well, a part of us did. Her, not me. There were always two parts to us, you see. The dutiful daughter was never enough, not for them. Though she tried, they said they could see my gleam in her eyes. It wasn't their fault, she would say. Of course they were cruel to her, to me. They'd never asked for a child with a demon inside. I offered to lend her my hunger, my rage, but she said that she wanted their love. She refused, so she lived her life patiently, hated, abused, and I, who'd have fought every battle for her, always trapped in a cage. But they knew I was there. They had seen that first smile, seen that razor-sharp grin. They told her that they knew exactly what waited within. Then the plague came. I really believe they were glad when we sickened, although they pretended to all of the neighbours to be very sad. But the look on her, my mother's face, it wasn't exactly disguised. That's the last thing that we ever saw, the relief in our own mother's eyes. Because yes, the plague took us. At least it took her, the good girl, the daughter, who tried to hide her double nature. She died and left me alone, suffocating, the cage she built to keep them safe from me disintegrating. And now I am free. I am no longer us, I am me. And perhaps if my parents had shown any love to their double-souled daughter, perhaps for her sake I could still rise above all the anger and sorrow and urge to attack. But they didn't. She's gone. And now I'm coming back.
Oof. Thank you very much for that. That was awesome. So we always like to start off by asking our guests, how did you first get into poetry?
I can't remember not being into poetry. Like, it was always very much a thing. Like my mum was an English teacher. There was always like poetry around. I can't remember a time when I wasn't going, oh, that rhymes with that. Let me write that down. but there wasn't really a poetry scene. Like, the first poetry night that I used to go to was in Keighley, where I'm originally from. There was a folk club where normally it would be like folk music and stuff. And once in a while, they would do a night where you could bring a poem someone else had written, like bring a famous poem and perform it. So it wasn't even writing your own. And it was me and my friend Rosie and all of our friends' parents. But me and Rosie were into
We've
it.
All so been
we were nice like, no, we're coming too. We're coming too. And just turn up and read like Warning by Jenny Joseph or like just like famous like poems. And then me and Rosie realised that if we read each other's poems, we were technically following the rules of reading someone else's poem. So we started doing that.
Cover band.
Yeah, incredible. Pretty much. And then in Sheffield, that when I first moved to Sheffield, there weren't really any poetry nights, but there were like variety, like cabaret type nights. So I would like turn up to them and be like, I could do a poem. And yeah, it was very much from the performance side of things that I got into it, I guess. Like, I like writing stuff that's going to sound good on the stage rather than, like, if it looks good on the page, great. But the thing that I love is seeing if it lands, if I perform it. So, yeah, I'm always looking for places that I can perform. And now there is, like, actually a poetry scene in Sheffield, so I can go to actual poetry nights rather than turning up to like a random other night and going, poem?
Hello.
Yeah. Well, this thing I was going to say, because we do kind of witter on about kind of the London poetry scene as much as we try and sort of, you know, think about the scenes outside of London. Obviously, we are all based in London. And that's kind of our frame of reference. So I'm always really curious to ask poets from other parts of the country, like, yeah, what's the poetry scene like in Sheffield?
I'm fascinated by this because every city and not just cities, every place that has a poetry scene, it just seems completely different to each other. So you'll think you know what the poetry scene is like, then you'll go somewhere else and it's like, oh, that's totally different here. All right. And what I notice in Sheffield, like, I've been here for, God, like 20, 25 years now, is that the poetry scene goes up and down. So there'll be times when there's like loads of nights and they're all really flourishing and everyone's going out to poetry, and then it'll have a little dip for a while and there'll be nothing, and then like someone will start something and people will go, oh yeah, poetry, that's a thing, and it'll come up again. And we seem to be in slightly of a dip at the moment, I would say, but which is making me itch to start something new and be like, oh, it's quiet, let me start another poetry night. But I do have a bit of a history of being like, oh, there's no poetry. I want to start a poetry night, but what I really want is for everyone else to start poetry nights so that I can go to them. So I'll start a poetry night and go, oh, look, poetry, isn't that nice? And then stop and wait for the rest of the poetry to turn up. Yeah,
I think that was something we were talking about with Daisy Thurston Gent the other month, was that, you know, you kind of go through phases, don't you? Start poetry, think, oh, yeah, this is great. And then you think, oh, I would like to be the person running the things because they're cool. And then you start running the things and you think, actually, God, I can't be asked with this. Like, I don't have time. Or, you know,
that is kinda, no, it's like nothing cycle to do with why we've taken a break.
It's a little bit to do with why we've taken a break.
What I really like, I've noticed this in Newcastle, and I'd love to make it a thing in Sheffield, is nights that aren't just poetry. So you've got like poetry and comedy and music and like, I don't know, magic. Like,
yeah,
whatever. Like having like a few different things on the same like roster seems like a good way to do a night to me. But yeah, in Sheffield, traditionally, it's been very, This is the sensible academic poetry, and this is the rowdy stage poetry over here, and never the twain shall. I'm like, no, let's do it all at the same time.
I absolutely love mixed bills, and I kind of see them a little bit as outreach because that's how I first found performance poetry. And yeah, there is part of me that feels like we are the like runt of the litter as an art form, and that we will get stamped on if we mix. I don't know if. Like, I remember there was a poetry night in London where they would then book headliners that were singer-songwriters. it was basically a poetry night. And then at the very end, they were like, and the best person, the main person, is not you. And I found that didn't work for me.
Yeah, what you need is the poets need to be running the night. And then be poetry. But also we've got a singer as well.
Yeah.
With their little plinky plinky guitar over there. Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, they need music to make their words sound good.
I do adore, like, Spoken Word London used to have kind of the occasional comedian who would come down, and you would sort of watch them step blinking into the light going, oh, everybody's nice to me here, aren't they? Nobody's heckling and you're trying to laugh.
Yeah.
Oh, and it was very sweet. It was like looking at an abused puppy or something. Okay.
Yeah.
But I think the opposite of that is I really like to be able to do poetry to a non-poetry audience, because then I actually know if the poem's any good. Because if I can get someone who didn't come to see poetry to like the poem, then I know. Whereas like poetry nights can be a bit like, yeah, we're going to clap anyway. Yeah. Like, no, like, tell me if it's bad. So I quite like a mixed audience for that.
Yeah,
that makes sense. Mm. I once had at Edinburgh Fringe, I had a comedy person come to my poetry gig and then came back afterwards. It had been like a mixed bill of poets, and came back going, I mean, obviously you were not you. You were great. You were fine. But the problem is, right, when you're a poet, you don't know if you're shit. Because if those people were comedians, they would be bombing. And he seemed to think that this lack of kind of gladiatorial element was a problem with the poetry scene. But if you come back from
a bad...
You
should go to slams.
Yeah. But also, like, if you come back from a bad poetry night, you might feel like you've, you know, read a couple of people's diaries. If you come back from a bad comedy night, you'll feel like you need to, like, dry clean your brain. That you've, like, listened to a bunch of hate speech. I feel like... There is.
Yeah. Oh, I've been to bad poetry nights where I felt like that.
Oh, yeah. Shit. Yeah.
God.
Talking of bombing and segueing into the Edinburgh Fringe and mixed bills, Hannah, do you remember when we went to the Fringe and we went to go and see a show about Pat Butcher in the Afterlife, a comedy show, and we were both so looking forward to it. We were walking up the road going, all right, Pat, 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 Pat. And we walked in and we were like, yeah, here we go, Pat Butcher in the Afterlife. And this teenage magician comes out on stage.
Oh, God,
like,
yeah, that was
everybody.
It. I was saying,
hello,
I think
everyone.
I don't remember
Thank
that show.
Thank you for coming to my magic show. And we'd got the date wrong. And you and me both had to sit through this poor little child's magic show.
Doing like
a whole
end
hour
of the pier bad dad jokes to a delighted audience apart from us sour gits.
You probably boosted his audience members. Like,
we did. But then Hannah just stood up at the end of it and shouted, worst Pat Butcher impression I've ever heard, mate.
Yeah, that's absolutely
She didn't do
what
that.
I did.
That never happened.
Amazing.
But on the topic of the Edinburgh Fringe, that is where I believe that's where each of us have first met you. You are a regular performer at the Fringe, which is this kind of boot camp for the performing arts. How do you go about putting together a show? What is your process? How do you?
Well, like I said, I like to write things with the idea of performing them in the first place. And what I don't want is, and I haven't completely cracked this yet, but what I don't want is to just be someone on a stage for like a full, like if you're doing open mic and you've got 5 minutes and you're like, yes, here's a poem. But if you're doing like a full show, not being like, I wrote some poems. Here's a poem. Here's another poem. And another poem. So trying to find some kind of like thread or like frame that I can put the and finding something, some way of putting them together. And while I really enjoyed the show that I did for The Fringe, I am working on making Monstrous more of a story that can become something that isn't just a list of poems, but like finding a way of threading all the poems together and making like a full narrative rather than, I've got you in the room now for an hour, listen to my poems. Being like, this is going somewhere. So that tends to be what I try to do when I when I put a show together.
Yeah, I think so. Yeah, like I was saying, I saw you on the Edinburgh Fringe this summer, and you had the most unfortunate show the time I was there, and I thought you handled it so well.
What does that mean?
It was like me and maybe three other people who I think. Maybe there was a couple and another guy who I don't think knew.
Yeah. You did not come on the best day, to be fair. So this is the thing that happened with the Fringe last year for me, was I was like, some of the I wrote a load of poems about monsters. Some of them are PG rated, some of them are not. And I was like, do I do a kids show? Kids are going to like monsters. And I just leave out the rude ones or the scary ones. Or do I do an adult monster show? And I went for the kids show option, but then the venue that I was going to do the kids show option, it pulled out at the last minute.
Oh no.
So I got put into the tiny room at Whistlebinkies. And Whistlebinkies is a lovely venue. They've worked with the PBH Free Fringe for years, and they're great and they were lovely. But it's like, basically, imagine a caravan, but in a cellar.
Next to the toilet, the small and competing room with the hand dryers as
oh
well.
Yeah, oh god, the fucking hand dryer, sorry.
You're allowed to swear
that
on
that wasn't in the PG version. Yeah,
the gosh darn hand dryer, which I kept saying was the Winds of Hades or something, because nice. Every time someone went to the toilet, there'd be a show on in the big room at Whistlebinkies, and that would let out about three quarters of the way through my show, and then everyone would go to the toilet. So the second, so the end of my show was just like,
flush,
talk,
flush,
talk,
flush.
Talk, talk, talk. So not ideal. It was the best venue I've done at the Fringe, as far as the staff being absolutely lovely.
Ooh,
but probably the worst as far as there wasn't a door.
God.
That's a big...
So, ambient handicap. Noise was a thing.
Yeah.
And, it was suddenly an 18-plus-only show when it had been planned to be a kids' show.
Oh, gosh.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
And which is, there's something about that is the potluck of the Fringe, right? That it just...
Yeah, I mean, yeah, I love it. I love the chaos. It's brilliant. And I will happily do Fringe shows, and who knows what's going to happen? Maybe it's going to be this. I really enjoy that. But yeah, that was it was challenging.
So tell us more about Monstrous. Why monsters? You told us you were starting to write about monsters, and we all went, oh. Okay, cool.
Yeah, because it came out of NaPoWriMo or something, didn't it?
No, kind of. I've done a thing. I don't do it every year, but if I get a good idea for it, between March and June, I try to write 100 poems in 100 days. And if they're good, and it goes over NaPoWriMo, but I didn't know that was a thing when I started doing it. And if it goes well, then I have a load of poems. And if not, it was an exercise. And if really not, then I stop doing it. If it's if it's not working. But I've always been a bit autistic special interest about mythology. I've always been really into finding out about different cultures and them, what they find scary, I guess. Or what they find sacred, or just what monsters did you invent or discover in your culture, and what does that say about it? And I've always been really into that. So, and like you said, when I was I'm going to do poems about monsters, and previous to that, I'd done poems about identity and my life story and the stuff that you kind of see a lot on the poetry scene. And I kind of felt like I want to do something completely different for a while. I want to break from the, here's a poem about some trauma that happened to me thing. Cause I kind of felt like I'd done it for too long and wanted to do something different. So I started writing these monster poems, and actually that turns out to be a way of talking about trauma, because talking about being different and talking about being other and not it worked its way back in, but through this other lens of no one likes goblins, I'm autistic and trans, that this has no bearing on this whatsoever, I promise. No.
It's really funny, isn't it? We've talked on the podcast before about how in performance poetry there's kind of this assumption that when you perform a poem, it's true and it's a real authentic representation of something that you've been through. But actually, to get to that, sometimes you have to go through fiction or myth or these different kind of lenses to and you don't necessarily realize when you're writing, like I did a fiction project last year, you kind of don't really realize until you're doing it that it's like, oh yeah, no, this is all about me. Okay.
I think one of the reasons I wanted to do Monsters is that I could do fiction and not have people assume that it was like my life story. Because one of my like 100 poems things was like writing poems about people that I knew. And some of the times I would do it from their perspective. And I remember writing this poem and I wanted to perform it at a night that I was at. And I was like, this is not my story. This is a poem I've written about my friend and it's with their permission that I'm performing it. And it was about a guy that I was friends with who was realizing that he was bisexual and he thought he was gay and then he thought he was straight and then he'd been like, oh no, I'm bi. And I was like, this is not me, this is somebody else. But honestly, my introduction to the poem was longer than the actual fucking poem. And still, when I'd finished, I had some creepy guy come up to me, like, oh, I'm really glad you've decided to give guys a chance. Oh, like, it was really brave of you to share that.
Never underestimate the ability of creepy guys to be creepy.
Sorry, editor.
having both talked over each other in an enthusiastic manner, shall we talk neurodivergence?
Good segue.
I realize this is a weird question because obviously, like, you've not had a plain brain, tried on a plain brain for size to compare. But how do you think being neurodivergent kind of impacts on your creative process or informs it?
People have asked this before, and in my like most of my friends that I've met that turn out also to be neurodivergent have been through the poetry scene. I feel like the poetry scene is a really like neurodivergent, neurospicy, friendly place, because where else can you get up on a stage, monologue about your special interest for 3 minutes and then get off and you don't have to talk to anyone else if you don't want to, because you could just be a moody artist.
Yeah, that's incredible.
It's perfect. Yeah. The poetry scene is how I can socialise. Because, yeah, like put me in a pub where I've got to make small talk for a night or a nightclub where it's really loud and horrible. I don't know. But, like, poetry nights and I guess, like, various kinds of performance nights, there's a structure. You know what to expect. No one's going to think anything of it. If you're like, I'm out, I need to go outside for a bit. Like, that's totally acceptable. It's not how do I, like... How does neurodivergence like affect it? I go to poetry nights because I'm autistic, and they are really autism friendly place, even if they're not trying to be. Like, some places are like, oh, we've got a quiet room, we've done this and we've done that, and we're gonna have like quiet clapping or I don't need that. I just need to know that I'm gonna have my turn to talk, and then I'm gonna have to listen to everybody else talk, and I'm gonna enjoy it. But I'm not going to have to work out when I'm supposed to be saying things back, because it's a poetry night and I can like clap at the end or I can tell them what I thought at the end. Yeah, like poetry nights are just really autistic friendly by nature rather than by design.
It's funny, I always think of poetry nights, you're like, I never know what's going to happen. It could anything could happen, but actually you're right. It does have these structures and rules and things in place that actually kind of go against that. Like certainly with slams, it's like, and now the maths.
Well, my favourite thing is like chaos within a structure. So like there can be an amount of, but you also know that this bit's going to last this long and someone's going to say something if this bit goes wrong, but you can still play around with it and things can still happen, but everyone understands what the rules are, which is just not, I mean, maybe it is that I don't, like you said, I'm not autistic. I'm not neurodivergent. I don't know how other people experience the world. Maybe for everyone else knows the rules all the time. But like, if I'm just in the pub with some people and I don't know, like what someone's going to consider appropriate or inappropriate. If I'm at a poetry night, I know exactly, like, that's okay. That this is fun chaos. This is bad chaos.
Yeah. I also just think there's something about poetry encourages you to look at stuff slightly, or poetry works best when you are looking at stuff slightly differently, right? And I think if you grew up with an awareness of, hang on, I see things slightly different to you, I think you're already in a good space to be doing poetry very well. Like, it's not a very well sort of expressed theory that I've been nursing about why poetry is such a neurodivergent space as well.
Yeah, I don't know. Like, I'm sure, like no disrespect to our non-neurodivergent poets out there.
Plain brains are perfectly valid brains.
Yeah, we accept you.
Rebecca, are you and me plain brains? I think we are.
I think I am. I've never bothered to get tested for.
Poetry, so I have I have doubts. But
I've forgotten the name for the thing where you're clumsy.
Dyscalculia.
Yeah. There we go. I've had a couple of people go, have you ever thought about getting tested for that? So maybe, but generally speaking, no. I think probably plain brain. But yes, you're right.
I have said for years that I think that when you get your autism assessment and they ask you loads of questions, one of the tests that they should do should be, can you write a poem that scans, and does it bother you if it doesn't? Because I think there's something about patterns and things being right that makes like all the autistic, like all the poets that I know are autistic, they don't just write poems that scans. When they hear someone else write a poem and it didn't scan right, I can spot every autistic in the room because they're going, oh, it's wrong.
It's the princess. Well, maybe this does relate.
Damn.
Yeah.
And another thing we wanted to ask you a little bit about, as you were sort of saying, you've been doing the admin, you've changed your name, and you've changed that name since you've been performing as well and publishing. And yeah, we kind of wondered, is there a sort of tension between sort of maintaining your kind of identifiable body of work and then the reasons you've changed your name? And how do you relate to that work that's under a different name now?
I think it would have been more of a problem if I was good at self-promotion. but as it is, it's like, it's fine. There's always the risk when it's a trans person talking that people will think they're talking for every trans person, and I'm not. I'm just talking about my personal I don't care if people know my old names, and names plural, because I did have, like, previous to Tom Juniper, I had, like, I was Seren Thomason and Seren or Cez Thomason, and that was very much a, I'm going to choose a very neutral name that's quite similar to my birth name, so it's easy for people, because I was quite sort of like, yeah, I'm trans, but it's fine. It's easy. I'm not gonna...
Soft launch and... your trans identity.
yeah. I was like, don't want to be too much of a bother, but here it is. And then I was like, no, I've actually always wanted to be Tom. Tom Thomason was my middle name originally, and I always identified with it and wanted people to call me it. So I was like, actually, I get to choose. I'm going to be Tom. And yeah, that feels right. And yes, it's probably not the best business plan as somebody trying to write poetry to change your name every few years, but it's fine. like, if people know me, like, there's still people who call me Sez, and that's fine. I'm fine with that. People calling my actual dead name, birth name thing. I don't care if people know it, but I'd rather you didn't call me it, so I'm not going to say it, just to not put it in people's heads. But that's my past, and it's fine. Like, I've checked, like, everyone changes over the years. Like, for some people I know, it's like, oh, no one can ever mention my dead name, no one can ever mention who I was in the past. But for me, it's just like, yeah, like, I was that, now I'm not that. Hello.
Yeah.
And as far as poetry is concerned, I sometimes have to have conversations with people where it's like, no, you have met me. No, like, really, I'm not a new poet who's just emerging, like, that you've never seen before. Yeah. You have actually met me. I've just changed my name. Here's a picture. Yeah. Because I'm already bad at self-promotion, it's not any worse.
So no, and I mean, it kind of gives you a fresh start, doesn't it? I mean, in music, people release stuff under different names.
Yeah, a little bit, yeah. So, like, I think there may have been people who've been like, oh, who's this new exciting person? I'm like,
No, sorry, it's only me.
It's me again. I did get one gig when I was workshopping the Monstrous show to take to Edinburgh, and I got in touch with a night in Chesterfield called Spyrites that's run by two guys. And I was like, oh, if you've got any slots coming up towards August, I'd really like to try this thing out that I'm taking to Edinburgh. And Bob, who's one of the people who runs it, was like, oh, yeah, yeah, cool. Yeah, like, you could do this night. And I turned up, and Dave, the other guy who runs it, was just like, oh, my God, Sez! He had no idea.
Yeah,
the new poet who was coming was me, and I was like, yeah, change my name, it's me.
Yeah. I'm a master of disguise.
Yeah.
Do you think there's anything that kind of the poetry scene or audiences can be doing to support poets who've changed their name? I completely appreciate what you're saying about it all being very individual, so, you know, taking that as our starting point.
I guess just believe people when they say, like, this is my name. Like, I get, like, it can be difficult to get used to a name change, like, on or off the poetry scene. This is going to be true. Like, if somebody you know changes their name, don't freak out when you get it wrong, because you will, but just, like, work on getting it right more and more as time goes on. I guess on the poetry scene specifically, like, yeah, I don't know, try to, like, respect their new name, but also remember that they're the person who did the stuff in their old name. It's a weird, like, if they want to go back and be like, and change, all, like, I can't be asked, to be quite frank. Like, I could go back and be like, oh, I'm gonna find my login for this thing that I wrote in this name and change it all, and oh, I'm gonna reissue things that I've written in the past and put them in my new but it's a lot of work. But if people want to do that, don't be like, oh, actually, I think you'll find so-and-so wrote that. Like, just listen to people and talk to them. Like, if you're like, oh, I thought I knew you under a different name, just ask and be like, did I know you under a different name before? And this is your name now. All right, cool. I'll use that name. What's your pronouns? Yeah. Cool. Don't be a dick.
Surprising how often that is just the rule.
Well, we were about to ask you if you had a piece of advice for people who like to write poetry. You can just have "don't be a dick," but is there anything else you can add?
Don't be afraid of getting. It's fine if your poetry isn't perfect. It's fine if you fuck up. If you go to an open mic and do a poem and it absolutely bombs. Even to a poetry audience who are trying to be kind, they're still like, like, we've all been there. It's like, I have been, like, very held back by the, like, I've got to be perfect, I've got to get this exactly right. I can't go on the stage unless my poem's perfect. No, just go up and suck a few times and you'll learn stuff. Like, be bad at poetry and then you'll get good at poetry. That would be my advice.
That's a good piece of advice.
Before we ask you for another poem to see us out, where can people find you, and or do you have anything to plug? Where can people get hold of your book?
You can get the book Monstrous, which is a collection of poems about monsters, by going to ko-fi.com/TomJuniper/shop. If you look up the words Tom and Juniper, that's how you spell them. I am currently transitioning from Twitter to Blue Sky. I haven't quite managed to kick the Twitter habit, and no, I will not call it X, because I'm pretty sure Elon Musk would dead name me, so I'm going to dead name his app.
Yep.
But yeah, I'm kind of on there as Tom S. Juniper. And I am on Blue Sky as Tom Juniper, like all one word. So please interact with me on there to encourage me to use it more, because I'm trying to get away from Twitter.
Brilliant. Would you like to give us another poem to play yourself out?
Okay. Can I do a poem that didn't end up in the book but that I really like?
Yes.
Yeah. Yes.
B-side. B-side time. Yes.
Yeah, additional.
Exclusive bonus material.
Yeah, bonus material. That was the word I was looking for. So this is a poem about a thought that I had that people rubbing on a genie's lamp would probably be quite annoying if you were a genie. this is a poem that I wish I'd thought to put in the book, but I didn't. So, B-side. I'm not trapped in this primitive torch. Look at me, I'm the size of a human, that much you can see. And that thing in your hand, which I magically came from, far too little for me to fit into. And yet. So what does that tell us? Ding, ding, either I can get small or it can get big on the inside. Oh, for goodness sake, don't start explaining your headcanons, please. No, I'm not the doctor. No djinn was ever a doctor. What the hell is a TARDIS? So, at least we've established my home is enough. The Wi-Fi's not great, the reception is rough, the bronze walls interfere with the signal, but then it's secluded and comfortable, pleasantly zen. Room for me and perhaps the odd guest now and then, but there's one thing I should clear up once and for all. I'm not trapped in this bottle, you see. I'm not waiting here to be set free by some dumb passerby on a quest who is fresh out of luck and thinks he by some well-meaning spirit is blessed. When you rub on the lamp, you do not release me. You're stopping me having a moment of peace. See, I'm nobody's slave. It's my name on the lease. Be a darling and move on and don't bother me, please. It's all my own fault. Yes, I set up the bargain. You rub on the lamp and then boom, here you go. You've got your three wishes, exactly enough to get you in trouble. Not out of it. No, the idea was to put all you gold diggers off, that you tie yourself up in impossible knots and think, better not bother the genie again. We shall know better now than to mess with a djinn. But instead, you came flocking like idiot crows to extract your three wishes, because everyone knows that the djinn is just dying to serve all your wants. Doesn't think you're a bunch of self-satisfied, condescending humans. Not at all. Just come rub on the lamp and you'll see he will grant all your wishes with his wishes for three. No, fuck off. The deal's off. Please just leave me alone. Don't set up a meeting. Don't email. Don't phone. And don't rub on my lamp. If you do, I'll make certain the wishes you make lead to your final curtain. I'm sick of your nonsense. I really can't win. Tell me, where is the tonic to temper this gin?
This month's book is 100 Lockdown Sonnets by Jacqueline Safra, chosen by Laurie. Laurie, why did you choose this book?
Because I love sonnets and Jacqueline Safra is the best at them. And so I thought, why not have 100 of them? End of discussion. Yeah. No.
This felt very much like your mission statement of I love sonnets. You will love sonnets too. Sonnets, yes.
No, that's not quite.
Evangelism. It was sonnet evangelism.
That was this week's Dead Darlings Book Club. No, actually the reason is that we covered on the podcast a little while ago the book The Craft out on Nine Arches Press. And in that book, there is a essay by Jacqueline Safra about sonnets. And I remember reading it at the time, and I remember talking to you guys at the time about that book. And we sort of said, oh, I like this book about The Craft, but like this bit, the fact that it's gone in so hard on form at the beginning before talking more generally about writing is maybe something that wasn't working so well about the structure of that book. But I always really found that essay that she wrote really fascinating and interesting. And she talks in it about this poem by a poet called Edna St. Vincent Millay that has the first line, "I will put chaos into 14 lines and keep him there." And there's something interesting in this idea of using form as a way of making sense of the world, and using form as a way of giving structure and helping to carry on. And actually, we were just talking with Tom Juniper in our last episode about how poetry is in some ways built a lot around structures and around rules that are maybe not
That was a taster for our book club mini episode, which will be out later this month, wherever you get your podcasts. So what should our listeners be looking out for this month? Laurie, what have you got?
So I've got a bit of a cop-out answer, but I think it's a good answer. We've been away for a while, and people might not be aware that we have a back catalogue of amazing Dead Darlings interviews with some of the best poets in the country, or maybe even the world. People like Selena Godden, Dean Atta, Anthony Anaxaguru, Hannah Gordon, just a huge back catalogue of amazing episodes. This is episode, 41 now? So that means we've got 40 episodes in the back catalogue. They're available wherever you get your podcasts. They've been there for a while.
Plus
bonus episodes and Christmas episodes and all sorts of shenanigans. And we've been away, but those episodes haven't been away. They're all still wherever you get your podcasts. And they still make for a really good listen. So my plug is for our own back catalogue, but I think that is absolutely fine.
Why not? Why not?
I do recommend it.
Hannah, what have you got for us?
So I would like to do a shout out for someone who is doing some work to gather the nights together, which is the poet Fiona Broadhurst is running started a project called Where the Word Things Live. Like Where the Wild Things are, but Where the Word Things Live, which is wheretheworldthingslive.wordpress.com. And this is a catalogue of poetry and spoken word events in London, which is a heck of a lot of admin. So shout out to anyone who do that, let alone that is making it that bit easier to find. Ooh, I am free on next Wednesday. What's on? I'll find a thing. And someone I think I've probably mentioned before, but also there's a Facebook group called Poetry Plus Events Online, which is run by another great poet, Vron McIntyre, which is also, but that's for all the online events, not necessarily in London, so that wherever you are, you can find out what's on and what you can attend. And I just think it's way cool, and I could not I could not do that if you paid me. So thank you to those people doing those things.
In that same spirit, I can add a bonus shout out to Angela T. Carr, who collates submissions, opportunities and competitions and stuff on their WordPress site, which is angelatcarr.wordpress.com. Every month puts up a big list of all the submissions opportunities they can find. And that's always really helpful if you're looking to submit your work.
Brilliant. And anything you guys want to plug personally?
Sure. I want to plug Lemsip for getting me through this episode. you can find me on Facebook and Instagram at Laurie Eaves Poet, which is LaurieEaves Poet, or on Twitter at Mr. Leaves, MrLeaves. My book Biceps is out on Burning Eye Books or in Brick Red Cassette on Buried Vinyl. You can pick up both versions from my website, laurieeves.com, and stream the audio version wherever you stream audio.
And I am Hannah Chutzpah on all the platforms, trying to not be on Twitter because bleh. Hannah Chutzpah Poet on Facebook, and I have two books for sale. Having rearranged my flat, my spouse has now seen how large the box under the bed of unsold books is and went, oh, Jesus, oh, no, oh, we need to plan something. So please buy my book. It's a matter of personal embarrassment how many remain unsold. You can buy those on my website. It's hannahchutzpah.com. Hannah is spelled like you'd expect, and Chutzpah is C-H-U-T-Z-P-A-H. mobybook.com. And then there is, shop is one of the top links. Buy Mobybook, please help me make room in my flat.
You can find me on Twitter and TikTok as at Rebecca K. Cooney, Instagram and Threads as at any name but Becky, Facebook as Rebecca Cooney-Poet, and you can find copies of my pamphlet, Where the Lights Come On, at RebeccaKCooney.BigCartel.com. If you would like to support the podcast, you can do so with money by donating to our coffee page, which is coffee, which is ko-fi.com/deaddarlingspodcast. Or you can leave us a rating and review wherever you get your podcasts and help us spread the word. You can find the podcast on Twitter and Instagram as at Dead Darlings Pod, Facebook as Dead Darlings Podcast, and you can email us at deaddarlingspodcast@gmail.com. Thank you to our guest, Tom Juniper, to my co-hosts, Lauren Hannah, to Texas Radio, to our theme music. Thank you for listening.
Bye.
Bye.